good morning. First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for this very exciting workshop. Being an optical spectroscopist, I've spent most of my life in dark rooms, windowless rooms, so this is a very refreshing change. Okay, so what I'll try to do here is touch upon two topics. And in the first part, I would like to discuss, you know, the photoexcitation processes in organic photovoltaics, and followed by what I think are some of the theoretical challenges in this field. And the second topic, which is a topic which is very near and dear to me, is inelastic light scattering. And I just want to show you an example with a blue emitting polymer where we've looked at both experiments and some amount of DFT calculations, you know, of the Raman spectra. And then, if there is time, talk about this a very simple phenomenological model, which is the bond polarizability model, and this has been extensively used in the fullerenes for, you know, calculating the Raman intensities. So just for a brief introduction to these materials, maybe most of you know about these, and so this whole field of conducting polymers, of course, has received a lot of interest since the late 70s, when it was first shown that polyacetylene can be made a conductor. And this is the first paper co-authored by the three Nobel laureates, Heger, Shirakawa, and McDermid. Now, to have these double bonds, of course, what one requires is the sp2 hybridization, and this is just a cartoon that when you extend the chain and, you know, you take into account three-dimensional interaction, you can think of these homolumo bands, which are made out of these, you know, from the pi star orbitals. Okay, so some of the other prototypes, you know, there is the polythiophene system. This is heavily used, for instance, in the photovoltaics. The polyparaphenylene system, which is these phenyl rings, you know, attached by single bonds. We worked a lot with this polymer, which is polyfluorine. It's basically two phenyl rings attached together by this bridging carbon, and then you attach these long side chains. Depending on what the side chain conformation is, you know, you can get different backbone conformation, which of course controls both the optical and the electronic properties. Then you have this, the acene series. Now, fundamentally, you know, the conduction in these materials is, of course, quite different. Many of you may have seen this animation. This is from the Nobel Prize webpage. So, for instance, if you have a polyacetylene chain in the presence of iodine, what you find is, you know, the electron, you can see it here, the electron goes to the iodine molecule, and then the lone electron, it sort of moves along the chain. The positive charge, on the other hand, is more strongly bound to the iodine. So that does not move that easily, and if you have, you know, many of these chains which are heavily oxidized, then you have these pairwise condensation of the solitons of the polarons. So before going into the photovoltaics, what I thought was, you know, just give you a very brief overview of the optical processes in these materials. And, you know, this is, of course, a very simple picture. So you have, when you have the red lines here indicate the absorption of a photon, you know, via the creation of the singlet excited state. We have to remember here in these molecular semiconductors, the excitons are very tightly bound. They're the Frenkel excitons. So after excitation, de-excitation can occur in several ways. You can have non-radiative recombination via the creation of phonons. You can have radiative recombination, which is what we call photoluminescence. Now, in addition, you can have processes like an intersystem crossing over due to a higher spin orbit coupling, so you can populate the triplet states. This experimentally, for instance, can be observed using modulation spectroscopy, so one can probe these triplet-triplet absorption states. Additionally, you can have a dissociation of the singlet excited state forming plus and minus polarons, giving rise to these kind of intrapolaron absorption. Now, optically, you know, for a pure polymer chain, one really does not see the polaron absorption, but if there are many defects in the polymer chain or whenever you have a charge transfer, one can probe these kind of intrapolaron absorption as well. Okay, so to look a little bit more closely into the, you know, the interchain photophysics, so one can imagine that this polymer chain is something like a series of one-dimensional potential well, you know, representing the effective conjugation length. And so as long as you come in with an incident photon, which is higher than the band gap, absorption will occur at all sites. And then you form the excitons, and that is, that happens in very short time scales of the order of sub-picosecond. And then you have the exciton migration to the longest chain segment, which is the lowest in energy, and this typically happens over, tens of picoseconds. So the luminescence that you see is really from the longest chain segment, or which is, the lowest in energy. So typically, when you look at absorption and photoluminescence, they have this mirror image rule. So for instance, what is shown here is, this axis, the x-axis is the energy axis. So in the absorption, what you'll find is that the 0,0 will be the lowest in energy, whereas the luminescence is, of course, from the lowest vibrational state. So the 0,0 here would be the highest in energy. And the separation between the 0,0 and 0,1 is basically the phonon energy. Yes?
How long typically is the longest chain segment?
Okay, what chemists, for good polymers, 80 to 90 is a very good conjugation length. That means you have 80 of these units till you hit a defect site. Okay. Yeah, that's probably a good,
And this is a typical spectrum that the phonons are so nicely visible?
Okay, the phonons are usually...
semiconductor physics, and that's very rare in some ways.
That's correct. You don't see the vibrational spacing there. But for instance, I'll show examples of a methylated polymer, and you see even in the absorption, this beautiful replica. And of course, it has to do with, the defects. So for many of the polymer chains where the conjugation length is only 20, 25 or something, you will not see it in the absorption. But typically, you would see it in the luminescence.
Okay. What's the energy scale?
The energy scale here, good question. So again, with these polymers, most of them would be, the band gap would be between 2 and 3 electron volt. And that is actually a challenge for the solar cell part, because you want polymers with low band gap. And it's synthetically, it's a challenge to make these materials with a low band gap. Okay. And of course, then you have interchain photophysics. So basically, you can have things like an aggregate state, which is something which is stable in the ground state. So you have these electronic, the wave function is sort of delocalized over several chains. You can have something like an excimer, which is one way of thinking about it is it's an exciton, which is, spread over two or more chains. If you have two chromophores, then, the excimer is basically called an exiplex. Now, because of these, when you interpret, let's say, a photoluminescence spectrum, it becomes quite a challenge, especially in the solid state, because, you have these kind of effects as well. So this is just an example of photoluminescence spectra of a polyfluorine sample, which is a blue emitter. So here, I guess, you can see the energy scale. The 0,0 is at about 2.9 electron volt. What happens in the solid state is you see that there is this low energy feature, and this can now be due to, of course, several reasons. It can be due to aggregates. It can be due to excimers. These materials are also notorious for something called, a keto defect, whereby you have an oxygen atom attached to this bridging carbon, and that's, again, a low energy state. So the only way you can figure out, where this low energy emission comes from is to do time-resolved experiments, because, the time scales are very different for excimers or defect states versus your singlet excitons. Okay, so, these are, so the next, the first topic is really I would like to touch upon the organic photovoltaics, and these organic semiconductors provide a very viable platform for low-cost solar cells. Of course, their efficiencies are still very low, and if you look at, the efficiencies of various solar cells that are available. So for instance, amorphous silicon is, this green line here. Then crystalline silicon is this blue line, and the organic semiconductors fall right here. These are still numbers from last year, but roughly it's about 6% is the efficiency. But the whole idea is because these materials are flexible and, and they can provide you with the low-cost solar cells. I think the current, if I may be wrong, but in California, it's something of the order of the silicon photovoltaics is 30 to 40 cents per kilowatt hour. And we would really like to bring that down below 10 cents. And there is hope for these materials. So how do these things work? So typically what you do is it's a blend of two materials, a donor and an acceptor. System that is heavily used and gets, you know, gives you about 4 to 5% efficiency is polythiophene, where that acts as the donor, and a fullerene derivative, which is PCBM, acting as the acceptor. So you have a blend of these two materials, sandwich it between two electrodes, and basically what you need is a good phase segregation. Now, of course, what you're doing is you're creating excitons in the donor material. Then you, when you reach these donor acceptor heterojunctions, that's where the dissociation occurs. So there has to be an optimum distance, you know, between the two components for these excitons to basically diffuse. Few things, it's probably one of the fastest, you know, photo-induced transfer rates, which is something like 50 femtoseconds. The other thing is there is an asymmetry between the forward transfer and the back transfer, which is quite fortuitous because that's why you can collect these charges. So just to, you know, elaborate on this process, you have these donor-acceptor, you know, junctions. So basically, with the absorption of a photon, you're creating a singlet exciton. Some of it recombines. That is, of course, useless for us. But at these heterojunctions, what you're forming are some kind of geminate pairs, and, you know, they dissociate to form free charges. Turns out the process is not so simple. And most experiments show that you form an intermediate charge transfer complex, and that further dissociates into free charges. The other process that also happens is you can have these CTCs which are into trapped states, they recombine, so again, this is useless. So the question that we wanted to ask in this whole process is, along with these singlet triplet, you know, singlet excitons, can one also utilize triplet excitons for charge conversion? So basically, can we get a material where we have a higher fraction of triplet excitons and then utilize that into getting charges? So for that, we used, you know, the ladder type polymer system, and we used two polymers. The one in blue, which is this methylated ladder type polymer, which is the non-triplet enhanced, you know, polymer. And the other one, this PHLPPP, is the triplet enhanced, whereby the difference in the name comes from, because, you know, in this polymer, what you do is you have to do a slight side chain sequence. There's a slight difference here because we wanted to get the palladium atoms incorporated in the backbone itself. And what that does is it enhances this ISC. So, in all respects, the two polymers are identical. They have the same homolumo levels, same band gaps. If you look at the optical signature, looking at the photoluminescence or the absorption, they're identical. The main difference is in this PHLPPP, you have about 100 ppm, you know, of palladium atoms incorporated in the backbone. So, yes? Okay, now that's hard. It is in the backbone. It is in the backbone. And that's why, you know, they had to come up with this. This is all material from Ulrich Scherf, where they have to do a different, they have to put a phenyl group here so that they can actually get it incorporated somewhere. I mean, we don't know where it's sitting, but it is in the backbone. So this is quite different from just, you know, mixing some palladium atom.
It's not chemisorption, it's just physisorption.
It is. And they can figure out, you know, from, I forget what they use, IDS spectroscopy, to figure out that it's these things are really sitting in the backbone. Okay, so one of the questions as well, how do we know that we have higher triplet excitons in this, you know, the PHLPPP sample? You can look at it with different mechanisms. So again, I want to emphasize that the two polymers have very similar energy levels. And, you know, the singlet triplet, of course, the splitting is because of the electron-electron interaction. This splitting is roughly 0.7 electron volts. And I think it's true for all phenylene-based conjugated systems. So one can probe this triplet absorption, so you can use photomodulation spectroscopy. It's very weak. If you just do the regular absorption, you will not be able to probe this. So for instance, if you look at the PHLPP sample at room temperature, you see the signature at 1.3 electron volt, showing us this transition and telling us that there are triplet excitons. Turns out in a regular luminescence, photoluminescence experiment, this transition is forbidden. The phosphorescence is a forbidden transition. However, if you make a light-emitting diode, which is whereby you can see the electroluminescence, it's recombination of charges, you do see this transition. So for instance, this red curve here, that is the electroluminescence from the PHLPPP sample, and you see this transition here. So it's giving you enough evidence that you have these triplet excitons. So what do we do next? We try and make solar cells, you know, from both the materials and compare their efficiencies. Now, I must point out that the P3HT PCBM system, which gives about 4 to 5% photovoltaic efficiency, there the electron mobility in the C60 derivative is comparable to the hole mobility in the polymer. So it's one of the best systems that you have. Now in something like this, the hole mobility in this ladder type polymer is three orders of magnitude lower than that of PCBM. So you will expect the efficiencies to be much lower. Additionally, the gap is about 2.8 electron volts, far from your ideal 1.5 electron volt, what you need to convert solar photons into charges. So basically, we use both the polymers and different, you know, blend ratio. Again, you really just mix these things in a solvent, sandwich it between two electrodes, and then look at the electrical properties. So here, this shows, you know, just for one of the blends, the current voltage characteristics. And if you just note the last column here, so everything in red shows it's the triplet enhanced polymer, and the black is the non-triplet enhanced. And yes, the efficiencies are very, very low. It's of the order of 0.2%. But systematically, what you see is that in the triplet enhanced blend, the efficiency is roughly, I would say, here it's a factor of 10, here it's a factor of 3, so it's much higher than the non-triplet enhanced polymer.
I probably missed something. When you say efficiency, this is the absorption process, or does it really include absorption, transport, and emission?
Okay, this is the photovoltaic efficiency, which really depends on, you know, looking at IV characteristics like this. So you're looking at the fill factor, of course, the open circuit voltage depends on your
real device.
The very next graph here, I have the external quantum efficiency. Okay, and so this is what you're seeing here is basically the ratio of the electrons that you're collecting at the electrodes divided by the photons at a particular wavelength. And yes, I mean, if you look at, for instance, the P3HT system, this EQE is over 60 to 70%. You know, here it's much, much lower. But again, what you find is that this triplet enhanced polymer gives you a factor of almost 8 more than the non-triplet enhanced. So what is happening here, you know, so we attribute this enhanced photovoltaic efficiency as well as this external quantum efficiency to the mobile, you know, the long-lived triplets. And again, you know, we don't know exactly what the fraction of the triplet excitons are, but they're small.
But your understanding is that the triplet just helps to separate the electrons and holes at the end.
I think it's because they are forbidden. I mean, they cannot re-emit. So
right, but you want to separate them.
You want to separate them. You want to separate.
When you create this thing, you don't want necessarily triplet, but when you want to separate.
When you want to separate them, so you have these additional triplets which you're trying to separate. So what we did at this stage, you know, to try and understand what is really physically happening, is we tried to look at this charge transfer process using photomodulation spectroscopy. And So here essentially what you do is you come in with, so that's a pump probe system, but the pump is chopped, you know, just with a mechanical chopper. It's not because these things are very long lifetime, so these mechanical choppers, you know, go up to about 1 kilohertz or so. And you have your sample here, and you have the probe beam, which is typically a halogen lamp that you use. And you can look at the transmission, so the changes in the transmission divided by the transmission. So in all the spectra that I show here, it is really delta T over T. And this is for, you know, one of the blends. I've sort of changed the colors, I just realized. Here, the blue here is the triplet enhanced polymer. And what you find is a completely different signature for these two materials, right? I mean, optically, they have the same features, the absorption, photoluminescence. But in the PIA, when you have these blends, you see a completely different signature. So for instance, in the triplet enhanced polymer, what you're seeing is a peak at about 1.65. So this is from some absorption process. In the non-triplet, you see these negative peaks, which correspond to some kind of emission. And you have these two peaks roughly at 1.45 and 1.58 electron volt. So we looked at all the blends that were used for the solar cells. And one thing is, corresponds to the photovoltaic efficiency that you see here, is when you change, for instance, so this is the 2:1 blend, the 1:1 and the 1:2 actually gives the highest photovoltaic efficiency. And you see that these features become very weak, telling us, you know, somehow the charge separation is higher here, and that also corresponds to the PIA signal. Similarly, for the triplet enhanced, you find that this absorption peak actually decreases for the blends, which give us the higher photovoltaic efficiency. So based just on these results, can we say anything about these intermediate, you know, charge transfer complexes that are being formed? And here is, you know, just a cartoon of the energy levels. So again, the polymer, which is our donor, both the triplet and the non-triplet enhancer, they have the same energy levels. This is the PCBM, which is your C60 derivative. Now, to explain these negative peaks that we see, it would correspond to something like having a charge transfer complex, you know, at this energy, such that we see the two emission peaks, you know, the 1.6 here and 1.4, it may correspond to transitions like this. In PCBM, the S1 to S0, that is a forbidden transition. Now, the energy level of the CTC depends on the ionization potential of the polymer, and you would expect it to be the same for the triplet and the non-triplet enhanced polymer. However, the PIA signature is completely different, telling us that somehow the triplet states are contributing to this PHLPP sample. And to explain this, so we see an absorption at 1.65. EV, and all we know is that, you know, it's an absorption between two states, but we don't know exactly where the energy levels are with respect to the energy levels of the donor or the acceptor. But all we can say at this stage is that this is most probably due to these long-lived triplet excitons, and it's probably being, you know, populated by the triplet state of the polymer itself. So this is, you know, just a starting point for us. We have to explore other materials where, you know, again, we do the same thing of looking at a triplet and a non-triplet enhanced polymer. But all I wanted to get across here is that this whole photovoltaic process is quite complex, because it's not that, you know, the charges, the excitons just dissociate, because you do have these intermediate steps. And it would be very helpful for the community to get some help from theorists here. So,
ask you a question.
Yes.
If you have your level diagram here, this is very fine. But of course, you need also probably at the moment where you want to split these excitons, you have probably electrodes.
Yes, yes.
For example, typically, I could imagine these electrodes are metals, for example.
Yes.
And of course, so to say, if I think in electron correlations, I think somehow these electrons provide some screening. So therefore, could you mention that your level structure is...
Will changing. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
How large is this effect? Is this a tiny thing you can ignore, or is this a big thing you have to consider?
All I can tell you is subsequently there were solar cells fabricated, you know, just with the MELPPP, the non-triplet enhanced, where we were getting, you know, efficiencies of the order of 0.08 or 0.1 or something. People have got, I think, over almost slightly less than 1% just by fine-tuning the electrode. So it is probably a big effect. That's all I can, you know, experimentally, those are the only things that we have. So, of course, you know, these are very complex processes, and the problem is, you know, some of the simple theoretical models that even we tend to use in, you know, either in gas phase or if you're looking at transport, where you have a molecule between two electrodes, experimentally, these are extremely challenging experiments, and, you know, it's almost not feasible. And so the question is, you know, what can we do with theory? I was actually told by an experimentalist once that theorists are cheap, experimentalists are expensive. So keep buying them drinks and it'll work. I've been doing that and we shall see if it pays off in the long run. So what do we need here? We need a theory that, you know, can handle these large systems with these long range charge transfer excitations, and of course you have relaxation processes, so you probably have to go beyond the, you know, something like a non-von Oppenheimer approximation. In particular, let me just ask these few questions based on just the work that I've shown. Actually, before I pose the first question, even the idea of having triplet excitons, you know, what should be the fraction of triplet excitons? Because you probably do not want to convert everything into triplets since they also have a higher binding energies. So you have to, you know, you have to have a nice match of these singlet and triplets. How well does theory predict the diffusion length? And the reason for asking this is, you know, many of these parameters are controllable. So for instance, we can make these polymers as nanoparticles, control the separation between the donor-acceptor heterojunction. We can do high pressure experiments, you know, just to again see the optical signature, whereby again we can control the separation. We can add impurities, we can add magnetic impurities. So there are some controllable parameters that as experimentalists we have. And so it would be nice if we knew exactly, you know, what is an optimum diffusion length for these, for the singlet and the triplet excitons, for instance. The other thing is, how well does theory predict the energy levels of these charge transfer complexes? And it turns out this is an important aspect, because if you have below gap CTCs, you can actually utilize it for absorbing the solar photons. If, you know, it's at 1.5 electron volt, of course, that would mean that the way we fabricate these solar cells, we have to come up with new designs, but those are doable. And again, you know, if these things can be predicted, that means synthetically one can make different polymer. Well, it's probably not that simple, but at least one can start thinking in that direction. I also wanted to bring up, you know, this whole concept of CTCs. This is something that also exists in your light-emitting diode, where you have charge recombination. And in the literature, what you always find is that, oh, the photoluminescence and electroluminescence are exactly the same. Turns out it can be very different for many systems. And the reason is, you know, for instance, in ALQ3, which is a small molecule, the charge transfer states actually are below the singlet excited state. And there you can get a completely different feature of the electroluminescence and the photoluminescence. So that would be nice if there is, you know, one can predict some of these energy levels. The other question would be, you know, how different is this photovoltaic process when the donor-acceptor molecules are on the same chain? So we have been working with some molecules where, you know, the acceptor and the donor group are in the same chain. And it turns out that these are, you know, we've just been working with these materials. Without any optimization of the electrodes, you know, morphology, you straight away get more than 4% efficiency. So, of course, these things have to be explored. So the question is, you know, is the photovoltaic process exactly the same when you have something where, you know, the donor acceptor is in the same chain versus where you have a blend of the two materials? Okay, so I have quite a bit of time. What I would like to do is probably come back to these questions at the end, if that is okay. Okay, go ahead.
I just have a quick question, which was, you mentioned right at the start that the singular process is very, very fast. It's 50.
Yes, that's.
Now, I assume you're right that the process is substantially slower, nothing would work. Is that right?
I'm not sure, because the thing is, you also want these excitons to be able to move to these donor-acceptor junctions, right? So, for instance, the triplets are much longer lived.
Yeah.
And so, in a sense, it may work the other way. If you can slow down the process, it may help.
Yeah, but what I mean by that would work, I mean, if you take different materials and report it, this 50 femtoseconds, the ones that actually
give you high
singlets give you some kind of efficiency, are they all fast ones or are they much slower?
I would say the P3HT PCBM is what I showed. Most of them are roughly of the same order. But the problem is, The process is very fast, but if the mobilities are completely different, then it's a bottleneck.
Sure.
And so because if you could actually slow down the electrons, then probably that would be nice, because then you can collect them more efficiently.
It would be more efficient,
that would be Okay. Yes.
You said geometry is important. For instance, here of getting the donors and acceptors relative to one another in different locations. What sort of effects come from aligning the fibrils by stretching the polymers and so forth? Do you also get efficiency?
I know there are certain groups that have done that. But in the photovoltaic process, I'm not sure. Of course, stretching it, there have been experiments where in field effect transistors, for instance, the mobilities have been enhanced by stretching these polymers. But I'm not sure in the photovoltaics. Okay, yes, you had a...
Just to understand, when you say she predicted diffusion length, what do you really mean? I mean, we have diffusion in the polymer, but I thought actually the most important at the end is somewhat also the diffusion across polymer.
Yes, it is both.
And that very much also depends on the quality of your samples.
Absolutely.
Now, how can we know that?
Okay, so I guess what you're bringing up, the whole point is morphology, of course, plays a huge role here, right? I mean, how good is, let's talk about the P3HT PCBM system. I mean, how good is the morphology? I mean, how good is the phase segregation? At best, I don't know. I mean, another field that is growing equally is, you know, looking at some of these morphology using near-field optics, which is something we haven't done. Hopefully we can do that at some stage, and you know, then people would have a much better idea of the actual structure, which is I think something which is starting in this field now. Yes?
That kind of polymers, you have them almost wrapped by the side arms, don't you?
Depends which one. Depends.
Almost isolated from the next, isn't it?
Well, the side chains, you're right in saying, and that's why people also put side chains, because you want to avoid all these excimers. On the other hand, if you just look at a simple photoluminescence spectrum, you know, you do get quite a bit from the interchain interactions as well.
Mm-hmm.
You do. I mean, in a solid state, just by looking at...
This is very different from plain PPV or PT, where you polypropylene without side chains, isn't it?
Well, the MEL PPP, of course, has these side chains.
Yeah.
And if you look at just...
The MEH awesome.
But if you just look at the luminescence, forget about, you know, mixing them in blends, you have a low energy emission, which you see only in the solid state, but not in the solution. And that is perhaps coming from, you know, aggregates or excimers, or there is definitely some amount of that interaction happening. So although you have these side chains, but there is, you know... MEH can pi stack. This does not. No, this one doesn't. This one doesn't.
So I think, it's a bit difficult with this kind of polymers, because the side chains almost envelop the main chain, they look like very isolated. So I think that picture that she showed, the first slide of this long chain where the migration is along the chain but with kinks, for this kind of format,
it's more
visible.
Yeah, but is that enough for a device? I mean, really, to really bring the charges or the excitons to the PN junction?
You see the efficiency.
I think you have to go to cross-chain movements.
You're probably right. You're probably so. This whole exercise was to have two materials with, you know, one is triplet and the other one is non-triplet enhanced, and that was kind of tricky because in many examples you find in the literature where they just sort of mix these heavy metals, and there, you know, you can have these palladium atoms or platinum, whatever you're using, sitting anywhere. Yes.
So aren't these materials also put in some sort of solvent?
Yes, yes.
There are lots of different solvents which really changes the morphology like crazy.
Absolutely. So for instance, these were all done with chlorobenzene, and that's what we found was giving us the highest efficiency. And typically, the efficiency here is extreme.
No. How much chlorobenzene?
How much?
Yeah, I mean, what's the nature of the solvent?
You mean the actual quantity of the chlorobenzene? So they always use a ratio of something like 10 milligrams of the sample to 1 milliliter of the solvent. But then when you cast these films, you actually evaporate the solvent.
Some of the molecules may remain.
Yeah, but the solvent is typically, so it better remain, right? Okay, what I'll try and do in the next, you know, 10, 20 minutes is talk about this other system and maybe some of these things of, you know, the backbone structure will be clearer. This is with the blue emitting polymer, which has been heavily studied. It is, I think, one of the highest photoluminescence efficiency that you can get in the solid state, roughly about 60% or so. The polymer belongs, it's called this polyfluorine system, where you have, you know, different side chains which are attached to the bridging carbon atom, and just depending on what the side chain is, you can completely change the backbone conformation. So for instance, if you have ethyl hexyl, you know, you can have this kind of a helical structure where you have this 5x2 or a 5x1 helix. The dioctyl, for instance, can have, again, different conformations, but one of this is where the entire backbone is planar. Now, in this field, when these first electroluminescence devices, you know, the LEDs were fabricated, what people found was the blue emission would redshift. And it was called this beta phase, which you find, you know, the signature in the absorption spectrum. So imagine you have this long chain and you have, you know, a small fraction of these planar units. That's the low energy state. So the emission is dominated by this beta phase, by, you know, the emission from these the planar phase. So of course it was known that it is because of this, the planar backbone. So we wanted to ask, why does this happen, and, you know, how is that related to the side chain conformation? And it turns out the entire backbone geometry is controlled by the side chains. So to do this, you know, to really understand what this beta phase meant, we looked at Raman scattering. And, you know, all these phenylene systems would have the 1600 peak, which is this intra-ring carbon-carbon stretch mode. The 765 is this ring deformation. You see that in biphenyl, for instance. So what is shown here is the as-is polymer, which is this blue line below, the blue curve. I know both of them are blue here. The top spectrum is the spectrum from this PF8. This is all with the dioctyl polyfluorine, where it was thermally cycled, so these have a nematic liquid crystalline phase at about 160 degrees Celsius, so you take it up to that temperature, bring it down slowly to room temperature, and, you know, there are many changes that you see. Most predominant are, you know, the appearance of these new peaks here. The backbone carbon-carbon stretch mode, you know, that also shows changes. So the question was, you know, where are these peaks originating from? And this is where we tried our hands at DFT. So we did look at the Raman spectra of this, you know, the fluorine reads using B3-LIP with this 3-to-1G basis set. So what you need for the intensities is, of course, the derivative of the electronic polarizability. And, you know, so this is with respect to the normal coordinate for that particular mode. And Gaussian sort of gives us this, and then you sort of multiply it by the prefactors to compare it to the experimental Raman intensities. So we looked at limiting cases. So for instance, you know, just the monomer with different side chain conformations. So one is this anti-anti-anti. The other one where you have these gauche defects, so something like an anti-gauche-gauche. Then we had this anti-anti-gauche, just different side chain conformations. Additionally, we could change the torsion angle because this beta phase again corresponds to when the polymer is more planar. And you know, the alpha conformer is the more non-planar conformation. So this is just comparing the, this is not a polymer, this is just for the fluorine monomer, and the experimental results are for the fluorine crystal. And what you find is, we were actually quite surprised that the 3-2, you know, this B3-LIP gives very good, I mean, it's not the best, but the frequencies are comparable. And more than the frequencies, what I was very surprised is to see the intensities compare very well with the experimental Raman intensity. And so, you know, here everything is normalized to the 1600 peak, but let's see. So the red here is the experimental Raman intensity, and the black is what we get from this B3-LIP calculation. And it agrees fairly well. So with this, we I'll just show you one, result here. So again, in this dioctyl substituted polyfluorine, this is, I know this is slightly busy here, this is the experimental data, and as you keep warming up the polymer and you take it up to the liquid crystalline temperature, bring it back to room temperature, you know, there was this appearance of this 370 peak here. This peak gets stronger. And so what, you know, these are the calculated spectra from the monomer where the different side chain conformations. So for instance, this AAA would mean where you have the side chains in this anti-anti conformation. So this peak that you see, the 370, corresponds to, you know, this is the, it's like an accordion motion, it's the Lamb motion, longitudinal accordion motion. This is, you know, Lamb 3, the peak here at about 180 or so, that's Lamb 1. And if you have a different side chain conformation, the moment you have these gauche defects, these completely disappear. So the fact that experimentally, you know, after doing this whole thermal cycling business, you see this 370 peak and, you know, enhancement of this one tells us that the side chains are now more, or, you know, in this, they're this anti-anti conformation. So how does one relate this to the backbone conformation? Remember, this whole thing was to try and figure out why do we have this beta phase, which is whereby you have this polymer in a, you know, a planar backbone conformation. Okay, so then we did some gas phase MM3 calculations, and what you find is that to have these side chains in this anti-anti-anti conformation, you automatically require a non-planar conformation of the backbone. If you have these gauche defects, that's what makes the polymer, you know, more planar. So basically, when you do this thermal cycling, what it tells us, you have more of this conformation of the side chain, which automatically means that the backbone is more non-planar. Okay, so the recipe is very simple then. If you want to get rid of the beta phase, all you have to do is do this, you know, thermal cycling process, take it up to the liquid crystalline temperature, bring it back, you can get rid of the beta phase. And, well, we looked at all the other frequencies as well. I'm not going to go into that detail, but just to show you, the recipe is simple. So this is the electroluminescence from a PF8 device. And, you know, the red here is the as-is, which has got a certain fraction of the beta phase. And then when you heat, you know, do this thermal cycling, you can get rid of it. And so you can, you know, blue shift the emission. Now, I just wanted to show this example because we found that B3LIP actually works very well to predict both the intensities as well as the frequencies. And over summer, we were looking at it, looking at different systems like pentosine and P3HT, and where we started having trouble. So I'm not sure what the best theoretical method one should use to calculate the Raman spectra of these conjugated polymers. Do I have like 5 more minutes? Yeah? Okay. And you know, this is where we had done something many, many years ago. It's a very simple model which predicts the Raman intensities very well. And I just wanted to touch upon that. The so-called bond polarizability model, which has been extensively used in fullerenes, for instance, to predict the Raman intensities. It's the simplest thing you can imagine. What we assume is that the electronic molecular polarizability is basically the sum of all the bond polarizabilities. Assumptions, isolated bonds, bond polarizabilities, it doesn't matter what the chemical environment is. Cylindrical symmetry, so you have, you know, 2 transverse component, 1 longitudinal component, 0 order approximation, these the alpha parallel and the perpendicular, that just depend on the bond length but not on the rotation. So the bond polarizability for a pair of given atoms, you know, could be expressed in terms of the parallel and the perpendicular components. Now, what is it good for? It was actually shown in the early 80s that the polarizabilities from ethane and other saturated hydrocarbons could be transferred to diamond. And the reason you can do that is because, you know, the bond polarizabilities are sort of independent of the chemical environment. So what we found is with the fullerenes, the static polarizability as well as the Raman intensities, which depend on these, you know, the polarizability derivatives, can be predicted very well using the hydrocarbon parameters. And again, you know, the Raman intensity depends on this, the derivative of the electronic polarizability, and in terms of these alpha parallel and perpendicular, you can expand it. There are 3 terms. I'm not going to go into details, but turns out in carbon 60, for instance, you have 2 types of bonds, single and double. You need 6 of these parameters. So just to compare the static polarizabilities, so, you know, for instance, experimentally, one knows what the polarizability of methane is. If you want, you know, the bond, the carbon-hydrogen bond polarizability, all you do is divide it by 4, you get this number. Look at ethane, because we want to, obviously, the carbon-carbon single and the double bonds. So here, you basically know the molecular polarizability that is experimentally known, subtract the carbon-hydrogens, you get the carbon-carbon single. Okay? Then you move on to ethylene, subtract from the molecular polarizability the carbon-hydrogens, you get the carbon-carbon double bonds. And now, just use these 2 numbers and compute the polarizability of the molecule. It's remarkably close to what you have experimentally for C60. And this is just, you know, adding up the 60 single bonds and the 30 double bonds, nothing else. Turns out you can use the a similar approach for even C70. Of course, you have 8 different bond lengths, but you know, you can have a cutoff whereby everything below 1.425, you can treat them as double bonds, above that as single bonds. Again, just add them all up, and you get a number which is quite close to the experiment. Of course, we did a lot of, you know, looking at the Raman intensities as well. So just using the hydrocarbon, this is for C60 now, you have 10 Raman active modes. It's not the best, but you get sort of the main features, you know, the low energy. If you just look at the intensities, these 2 are predicted quite well using the hydrocarbon polarizabilities. Of course, this was not the best, so what we had done at that stage was sort of fit these and get, you know, better parameters. So now, of course, the experiment and, you know, these with the fitted parameters, you get a very good agreement. The reason for doing all this was, you know, we could take these parameters and predict the Raman intensity of different molecules. And it turned out that it worked very well, for instance, when we moved to C70. So this is the experimental, you know, intensities. This is the theoretical intensities using these parameters, which we got from C60. We have further done this, you know, with endohedral fullerenes. Again, you can, the intensities actually work out quite well. People have used this for this.
C60 and C70 in the gas phase, or is it in the crystal, or?
Okay, the experiments are actually in the solid state.
In solid state.
They are in the solid state.
And then you have also to include the polarizability of the other fullerenes of the solid.
You're absolutely right. So this is, but the, it turns out that, you know, there are in the low energy, if I remember right, I mean, you see the splitting of some peaks, but more or less the intensities are quite similar in the gas phase and the solid. So the one thing which we haven't tried, and this is something which came up because we started having problems with B3 lip, so is this something one can use for the conjugated polymers to predict the Raman intensities? I don't know the answer, and if one day I have time, we should, you know, look into using these these polarizability parameters for the conjugated systems as well. So before I end, I just wanted to acknowledge folks who have actually done all this work. Arif, who was my first graduate student, he did all the photovoltaics and the work with the polyfluorines. Chris Walls, an undergraduate student, did all the Gaussian calculations. I would like to thank Uli Scherf and Satish Patil, for the synthetic chemists, for providing us with all the samples. Michael Winokur has helped us a lot with the structure property relationships in polyfluorines. Jose Menendez and John Page, with whom I worked on this whole the bond polarizability model. So with that, what I would just do is put this slide up, and this sort of goes back to the first part of the talk, where, you know, how one can explain some of these, or if there is a mechanism of trying to figure out what the different processes in a photovoltaic, you know, in a solar cell is. And the second question is, for these conjugated systems, what is a good you know, theoretical methodology one should use, not just for the frequencies, but also for the intensities. Because it turns out in many of the experiments, you know, for instance, we are looking at FETs under operation, and you see that the Raman intensity is also changing. So we need to have a good tool whereby we can also predict the intensities. Well, thank you very much for your attention.
So we have time for
again, on your triplet excitons, how were you able to really create them?
How were we able to create them? Okay, so the whole idea is if you have heavy metals, you can enhance the spin orbit coupling. Mm-hmm. So you have a higher intersystem crossing over, which is what, to begin with, you have a higher fraction of triplet excitons in the system.
These heavy metals are not part of the polymer.
They are part of the polymer. They are part of the polymer. That was the reason we were stuck with this particular polymer.
And when you said that, there was something where you said actually these are fusisorbed, and I wasn't sure what was there. And maybe I misunderstood that.
No. This is part. So that's why, you know, in the polymer itself, they have to do a slight change in the side chain sequence so that they can get these palladium atoms sit inside the backbone.
I still cannot understand this inside backbone. That's why I asked if it was a fissisorption instead of a bond. I mean, this is not a bond. This is just like an anthocyanin or something.
Well, the thing is, it is different.
The metal there.
You're not just mixing the metal in the polymer.
No,
you're not just mixing it. It's.
I would like to calculate this thing, maybe to know where the palladium atom sits, but it cannot be part of the backbone.
It is part.
It would disrupt completely the conjugation.
It's a very. It's 100 ppm. It's not. You're not
that
adding.
It's a defect, and it's not.
Well,
I mean, the exciton will not be mobile.
The thing is, remember, even in the regular synthesis of any polymer, you do have these heavy metals sitting in the backbone. So for instance, in the non-triplet enhanced polymer, which is your MELPPP, you can get the signature of triplet excitons. You can see it at low temperature. So which means there is some remnants of the heavy metals.
You know, the triplet excitons, electro-created triplet excitons would be three-fourths of...
Yeah, that is a different thing. When you're injecting charges, of course, you have...
But anyhow, you can get injected charges or recombinating charges anyhow. I mean, even if it's not electroluminescence, if you split the excitons somehow, then...
They can recombine.
Then you could create a very, very tiny bit of them. But if you put a palladium atom in the back phone, you would.
It's a very small fraction. I mean, it's really 100. It's between 80 to 100 ppm. It's not.
But you're telling me that it replaces a carbon atom.
It's the
backbone.
It's sitting somewhere in the backbone, and we don't know where it's sitting. Otherwise, you wouldn't get such an you wouldn't be able to see the triplet excitons at room temperature.
And it's a stable situation, so it's not something which will.
No, it is stable. I mean, these things are.
If you can make a metal organic complex with these side chains, it could be quite close to the backbone and not in the backbone.
Let's see.
In the backbone, it would destroy conservation. But if it is organic complex.
And you know, the thing is, let me see if I can. I mean,
that should be not experimental.
No, it is a diphenyl group. This X is a phenyl group which they attach.
Phenyl.
It's just another phenyl ring here. And that is required. See, I don't do the synthesis myself, but what I've been told is that is required to have this palladium atoms go into the backbone. So if you look at, I mean, this is one of the polymers where you see a very nice vibronic structure in the absorption, which automatically tells you that, you know, this is, almost defect-free. Plus, you know, also this, of course, this is drawn in two different scales, but if you look at the Stokes shift between the 0,0 and of the absorption and the PL, it's extremely small.
That's why it can focus.
But it's again, I mean, the thing to remember is it is still a very small fraction. You cannot put in too much.
But I mean, a small fraction would still distort the polymer.
It probably does.
So a small fraction means you can hardly see this in any vibration spectroscopy, but it would be nice to get some idea actually
what that
geometry is.
Right. And I mean, the thing is, for instance, if you look at, you know, a Raman scattering, it's again the light scattering, you'll see exactly the same signature for the two materials. Luminescence absorption, you see the same thing. We've actually looked at, you know, the morphology using AFM, and again, you can't distinguish when you make these things into blends as well.
I mean, the question is, has somebody actually tried to characterize the geometry near the palladium? I mean, either by ab initio calculations or some other.
Not that I'm aware of.
You can do this.
Not that I'm aware of, no. No. XF hasn't been done with these. Yeah, it would be interesting. I mean, yeah.
That's necessary, I think.
Yeah. I mean, XF would be an excellent tool to look at this for.
Homeopathic concentration, you will hardly see the.
Homeopathy works here. Can you get more? It's been tricky. I think the synthetic route that they use, this is what they get. And so one of the things, you know, which I did was just because I don't do the synthesis, but I can definitely add palladium to this polymer, right? I mean, one can always add it externally. But there, things are very different then because you don't know, you can't control the triplet excitons there.
I'm not working in this field. I was just listening to your talk and was thinking at this Blackboard talk of Kieran, on Monday probably. And there was a small circle of physics which focused maybe on useless but understanding, on this bigger circle of chemistry which focused not on understanding but on doing it.
Yeah.
And the question is a little bit for me, where would be your optimal help in the theory community? For example, is it better for you to chop the entire spectrum of problems of these triplet and single excitons, the mobility, the diffusion, interchain and intrachain diffusion into individual, well-defined problems, getting an understanding of that? Or is it important for you to get the total complexity together?
would answer it, we need both, right? I guess as a very diplomatic answer. I mean, the thing is, you probably have to understand each of the process individually. And, you know, one of the things here is when, for instance, we don't know what is happening at the donor acceptor heterojunction, because you must be having some kind of a conformation change, you know, the van der Waals interaction between. So there's probably a whole lot of things just happening at these the heterojunctions themselves. So maybe a way to do it is, you know, sort of break it up into different parts, study it, but then we also need the whole picture, because experimentally, again, you know, these are, and many of these processes are so complex, we cannot disentangle the effects.
Breaking it up into individual pieces is, of course, an intellectual step. So if you
could... Cartesian step. It's the Descartes methodology.
I don't think I should wait for an ab initio treatment of the entire... and so putting on the chemistry hat, I mean, I want to make some comments about the second one. But clearly, you know, there are smaller pieces where a little bit of information could go a long way, right? Like knowing where the palladium is reminds us of some of the old the surface stuff, right? Where the molecule. So I think it works much better to a few real things. It might be Brownian density calculated.
So I'm actually from the quantum information program. So I have a question about transport in these systems. Which people keep using the word diffusion, but is that really the correct? I mean, so what experimentally is known about how whether coherent transport plays a role in these systems, or whether a mental picture of the thing rattling down like a bullet?
Okay, so. For instance, when we talk about transport, or I mean, you look at conductivities, things are different. So, for instance, if I'm looking at a field effect transistor, where I'm looking at, you know, conduction through the chain, the mobilities would be very different from if I'm looking at, for instance, in a light-emitting diode, where you're looking at the vertical conductivity. And in most of these systems, you know, apart from some of the smaller molecules, there's still this hopping transport. You know, that's the picture that we have. Now, here, of course, transport is important because, after all, you're breaking the charges and then you're dissociating it and then you want to collect it by the electrodes. But before that, what you're also doing is you have these singlet excitons migrating. Right, so in a sense, what I was, and that diffusion length is important because you want to match that length to the donor acceptor, you know, the spacing. You don't want these things to break before they can meet the heterojunction. And typically, what you know, if you look at, I think the people have done some model calculation where these diffusion length of the singlet excitons is of the order of 8 or 10 nanometers, which would mean that whenever you have these phase segregated materials, you want the donor acceptor, you know, to be at that separation. So in a sense, what I was talking about here is more of the diffusion of the excitons themselves. And the charges, of course, again, there are no free charges. It's all polarons, right? So one has to take into account, I guess, theoretically, you have to take into account the phonons. I mean, an electron-phonon interaction here is definitely a very important part.
I have a suggestion. We could set up a meeting, a discussion meeting on organic solar cells or something like that.
That would be great.
Tomorrow afternoon, is that a free time slot?
That's right.
Or next week, I don't know. Next week.
I was suggesting that seminar that you were telling me to do. I could do it on, not optics, just electronic structure of polymers. Next week, maybe. Yeah. It could be tomorrow. But
next week.
as long as Sushi is still here. And then we could, I don't know.
Yeah, that would be great.
We could make it a whole
day.
But we could probably meet on Friday just to discuss the procedure. We would be interested in. Like we had yesterday to get started.
We will rearrange the schedule at 2 o'clock, 2:30 today, right?
2:30?
That's good.
2:30 is the starting time today. And then we can write these things into the schedule and sell them a lot of this the next year. But yeah, I think it would be very interesting. So on this random intensities of polychloride, so you asked this question, what methodology?
It to use, yes.
You know, one thing is there are good reasons, which I won't really go into given that we're being recorded, to use turbomolt instead of Gaussian. Right, and then I think some people know why. I can't explain exactly why. Our Gaussian license will get turned off. So turbomold, I think, will be much more useful than we can do larger
systems.
I think you can do this sort of simple modeling of this bond polar model of the Raman intensity. I would guess, well, certainly that the parameters will not transfer for the conjugated polymers, and the model itself may not really work at all. It depends on how soft things are. But with a sort of good code, I mean, you can pretty much run things as large as you want, and so you may as well, in many ways, run the full electron structure code. I think you should really publish the 6311G star number. You can mention the 6311, right, that it works with the smaller bases. There are good reasons to.
You know, I was reading, I don't know, this is again, just I can show you some of these papers where they actually say the intensities don't work very well with the 6311G. I don't know why.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm not sure why the intensity, I mean, so there's something with the polarizabilities or, right? B3 lip, yeah.
Yeah, so we can discuss those sorts of details. You should converge your calculation, and therefore, if it goes bad, then you have to look at that, right? And if you're, as I think I mentioned, if you're publishing in the Journal of Chemical Physics, you probably stick with B3 lip, and you'll have to put up a discussion of your functional, right? The point that it doesn't work when you start increasing the bases, that I can suggest one or two others to
Yes, I know I should have tried something else.
It's fine. The option, even with augmented wavelength,
gets better. Well, but if you're looking at the conjugated, the polarizability of the conjugated polymers, right, there can be problems with LDAs and GPAs and so forth. So probably having a hybrid may help quite a bit, or a little bit, but that's
important.
So we're going to discuss
all. Okay, that'll.
Or not. But yeah, so these kinds of things. But it's clear then that you cut off this piece of the problem, and there's lots of sort of technology and good ways and bad ways to sort of tackle the problem, and that you can do, right? But then if you start asking us about the excitons and stuff, the morphologies that we don't know where things are, right? It gets a little trickier. More questions? Okay, well, let's thank Sushi again. And remember, the day before lunch, sign up if you're coming today.